Welcome to Outspoken Voices, a podcast by and for LGBTQ plus families anywhere on their journey. I'm your host, Emily McGranahan. I'm the Director of Family Engagement with Family Equality. Happy 2020, everyone. 2019 was a big year for Outspoken Voices, with over 20 new episodes released. It was a year of moving, challenging, and honest conversations about being part of LGBTQ plus families. This year will mark some exciting changes for the podcast and for me personally. By the time this episode is released, I should have welcomed my first kiddo to the world. So Outspoken Voices will look a little different in 2020. The show is switching to a seasonal structure. New episodes will be released once a week for about an 8-week period, starting in the early summer and again in the fall. Keep an eye and ear out for updates and special episodes between now and the first 2020 season. It's a short hiatus, but we're coming back. So, to ring in the new year, here are some highlights from 2019 episodes. Enjoy!
One of the things that was really fundamental for me about the 2016 election is that before that, I had the same opinions about everything. You know what I mean? I still had the same worldview, but I was a person that was just to myself. I'm very much an introvert, in spite of being on a podcast right now. But, and so I was never somebody that would kind of, you know, wear my ideas on my sleeve in the same way. And, after the election, I said to myself, I'm not going to accommodate other people anymore. I'm not going to be silent anymore about who I am and what I believe. And so the first thing that we need to do is go out and get a rainbow flag and put it on our house and be like, declare, you know what I mean? Declare our allegiance. And so that's something that I want to make sure to be able to teach Judah, is that he needs to be all of who he is and all of who he's going to be. And he needs to be, to say that out loud and to put it out there and to kind of really participate in the world and confront it when it's necessary to make sure that he can be safe and protected and make the choices he needs to make in his life. And so that again is one of the best things about bringing him to all of these things. And, you know, in protests, he's kind of watching all the people and seeing all the signs. And then we go to a pride parade and he's ringing bells and dancing. You know what I mean? And so it's a great thing to see.
From my perspective, also, you both have touched on a couple of things that I think are really beautiful that we had forgotten overall. And first of all, is intergenerational political dialogue. In real time, face to face. It hasn't happened for so many people for way too long, and it's happening now. You know, secondly, just the process of protest, it isn't the end of the conversation. Protest has always been a declarative statement in a further dialogue. I think that we're all getting used to that idea again. I don't know, that's a huge source of hope for me right now. It may be the only one, but it's still big, you know?
Absolutely. You both sort of touched on being your children kind of being a motivation to be out there, to be speaking up and showing up in these different ways. Could you just elaborate more on that? How is being a parent directly tied to your activism?
For me, it's everything. And Gumel, I'm sure you can speak to this as well, but I refuse to leave my child this mess. I refuse. I refuse to not try to clean this up and to, you know, call the other parents and everybody else around me. Because once again, we have to model active, there's citizenship in a country, but they're just a world citizen. They're just a human being. There's just a certain level of common decency that involves sometimes fighting it out over verbally, of course, and with signs, but, you know, righting the ship. Oh my gosh.
It's all about protection for me. It's, I want to make sure he's going to be safe. I want to make sure that he's going to live in a town that he's going to be safe. Our family, our kind of family, is in such a precarious place in a lot of different ways. We're a two-mom family. We're interracial. We're interfaith. We're women. there's a lot of intersections happening here. And so there's a lot of ways in which our family can be attacked and our rights can be taken away, because it's like Libby said, we have to right this ship and we need to protect as much as possible. All I can say is that it's worth it. It's worth it to get your family involved. It's worth it to make your voice heard. And it helps you to not feel like you're alone.
For me, in the moment on the day when I learned that my dad was transgender, when I learned that new name, my main question was just, what if we're out together, we're out in public, what if we're at our favorite bookstore and I shout across the way, "Dad," what if I just say it by accident, And I was always very close to my dad. So I just thought, oh my gosh, what if that happened? Like, what would we do? And so that was my big question, as a kid. And then over time, secrets were a big part of sort of how we navigated it as a family, because some of the professionals who were kind of helping Diana through the transition had suggested creating a family story so that my sister and I weren't ostracized, socially in our school communities. So we did, my dad became my aunt to people. And we would say, "This is Aunt Diana." And while that kind of helped with some of the social stuff for me and my sister, in school, I think in the long term, it became more complicated, because here we were telling this story that this was my aunt, and some of our extended family also didn't find out for a long time. So it does get complicated, when it comes to sort of keeping it a secret.
Yeah. Like for my family, when my dad came out, if you will, we were trying to figure out our own stuff. So having to explain to other people, we didn't know how to explain it ourselves. So I think we just wanted to deal with our own family unit and not worry about how it would look on the outside, because we don't even know what it looks like on the inside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I think there's so much in those early days of transition when you're navigating your own family identity, and you're also the parent who's transitioning is also navigating their own identity and sort of seeing how that will play out. So I think there's a lot of that kind of feeling around and seeing what that identity will look like in the long run. And at the same time, I do think one of the pieces driving our story was the fact that when my dad transitioned, it was not common at all. I really didn't know anyone who was transgender, apart from a few famous people previously who had transitioned. So part of it was also just not really having larger narratives where it fit in, or larger stories in society where it fit in. But I think there is that piece of navigating, where does this story fit into the larger world? And I would have been so excited to know any other, people with transgender parents, but I really didn't.
Yeah. Becca, when did you, or how did you find other people who had a transgender parent?
Well, I've been going to therapy since my dad came out. So I think my therapist went to a conference or something having to do with LGBT parents. I don't remember. But she got me into Collage, and which got me into the Family Equality Council. I'm trying to think of the timeline. My dad came out when I was 13, and I don't think I connected with Collage until I was 15. So it was a good amount of time before we found the resources.
Heather, do you remember when you when did you first connect with Collage, which is a national organization really by and for people with LGBTQ parents?
Yeah, so I found Collage. I want to say it would have been about, it would have been almost 20 years after my dad transitioned, which is unbelievable to me. But I did find collage a bit later, but I was so excited to find, just to find other people with LGBTQ parents. And through collage, then I found, you know, at the time it was called KOT or Kids of Trans. And, you know, you had that, the KOT guide, and just reading that guide was so incredible for me. Just because I felt like, oh, this is my experience. And so it really does feel like a missing piece, you know, finding that community and finding those other people, and even meeting people, you know, who had two moms or two dads, or it was just this experience where they would, they just looked at me completely differently when I would share about my family than a lot of people with cisgender or, you know, straight parents. So it was just such a great experience.
So welcome, Chris and Robbie. I'm going to start with a question that I ask all the guests. Who is in your family and how was it formed? Robbie, would you kick us off?
Absolutely. So my immediate family is myself. I identify as a queer trans dad, and my wife, who is a queer cis mom. And we have two little ones who are 2 years apart, almost to the day, 1 and 3 years old.
Awesome. And Chris, who is in your family and how was it formed?
It is me. I am a queer trans dad as well. My wife is a queer cis mom as well. And our brand new little baby, she'll be 3 weeks on Thursday. And
Robbie, thinking back to, you know, when you were on the cusp of becoming a parent, are there things that, looking back, you're like, I can't believe I was worried about X?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that I, as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to be prepared. I read a lot of books, but I think what has transpired is that my approach was to be more of like a carpenter, where everything was exact and precise, and that I could imagine that how I built things is how the child would end up. And it's really more about being a gardener. And this is actually a reference to a book that I just learned about parenting styles. And, you know, parents generally think of themselves as carpenters with an exact, you know, blueprint. And gardeners know that how you have all your plans are really based on a lot of factors you can't control. And that's parenting. You just kind of go with it. And so I think I now trust myself much more to kind of have a gut instinct around what my child needs from me. And often that means nothing. Like, they just need to kind of like be on their own. A lot of it's been about learning, have more patience with myself and just figure out how to be like loving when they're having a meltdown, because he's three, you know, like the 1 year old doesn't have words yet. So how can he tell me he has a burp? Like, it's you just kind of realize that you're there for them. And that love is just so instantaneous. I'm sure Chris has experienced it, right? It's like, there's no lapse of time. It happens right away. It only gets better.
Yeah. Chris, you know, you've got 3 weeks under your belt. What had been some of your, you know, been most going through your mind in the lead up to the birth of your kiddo, and now, you know, has that changed at all?
I think the main thing going into it is wanting to be the perfect parent, wanting to make sure everything is perfect, wanting to make sure everything in the house is perfect. And clearly she had a different idea, because she came 4 weeks early, so I couldn't get everything done. But they don't care. As long as you feed them and you love them, you don't have to be perfect. Nothing needs to be perfect. And everyone starts off not knowing what they're doing, so there's no perfect parent. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned so far.
How did your trans identity then come into play when you were making some of those decisions about general parenting decisions, or coming up with a birth plan or parenting classes, you know, which hospital you were going to go to, like all of those pieces? Did that impact the decisions you made together as a family?
I think that did impact a lot, especially like from choosing a donor, because I wanted to choose somebody who knew, you know, that their sperm was going to a trans guy and his wife, and, you know, not just a cis couple. That way, if it was something that they didn't want, then they're not going to come back years later on after they find out and try to, you know, break apart a family. And then we went with a midwife just because they were very open about it and it was just a better experience for us. And the hospital we went to has been great as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is that my wife and I probably are not perceived as queer on a regular basis. I feel like I'm perceived as queer when I'm not with her more than she's necessarily perceived as queer, although she has a cute haircut now. So now I think she looks more queer and she likes it. So it's important for us to find ways to be out, but she also doesn't want to walk around using my trans identity as a way to like out her queerness. And so I usually just, you know, bring it up in a casual way. So I remember we were at the IVF doctor's office to start having a conversation about that process. And they wanted to understand like what the diagnosis was that led to us, you know, using IVF. And I said, oh, low sperm, as in like none. And they were like, oh, did you try this? I was like, No, you're misunderstanding me. I'm trans. And she was like, oh, got it. And she sort of laughed. So for me, it's like I use humor. I'm like, oh, the thing maybe I didn't sort of mention that sort of makes all this make sense.
And Sam, did any particularly interesting or funny stuff from your kiddos come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, quite a few things. When Sage was pretty young when I transitioned, so I would say, gosh, they were probably 3 or so. So just barely old enough to sort of explain it to them, and it had to be very simplistic. So, you know, as we were talking about, you know, taking hormones for medical transition, what testosterone does and that sort of thing, you know, they started calling it beard medicine, which I thought was a very cute label for what testosterone is and still to this day refers to it as beard medicine. Recently we're actually all out to eat as a family. And, there was this little boy sitting next to us, with his dad, and he looked over, he was maybe 5 or so, and looked over at Sage and just kind of in this mean tone said like, do you have a dad? Because it doesn't look like you do. And we just kind of didn't have any idea what to say because he was a little kid and he was with his parent and his parent looked mortified. And anyway, so we just went back to eating and kind of laughed because A, it's hilarious because Sage actually has 2 dads. And secondly, Sage was just so sweet and like came over and looked at me and gave me a hug and like held my shoulders and was like, I know you're my dad. You're a manly man, which I just felt like was very sweet and not normally something I would use as a label for myself in any way, but just a really sweet moment. Pretty cute.
Yeah. It is also true that kids can ask questions or say things that can feel surprising or shocking or sometimes, you know, hurtful to parents, you know, without the kids intending to necessarily be. As I grew older, I think I still feel pretty comfortable asking some of those questions. And part of that was definitely kudos to my parents for saying, like, if you want to talk about your donor, like, it's okay. It doesn't hurt us. We are open to it. But that's hard to do sometimes. And it can be really hard for some folks. Does that seem true to you as well in some of your experiences?
So I think, you know, when Adele was younger and she knew that she had the surrogate mom who gave birth to her, that was kind of sufficient. And more recently, thinking more and understanding more about, well, you know, who's your biological mother? She's wanted to get in touch with her. And, you know, we had a written agreement and we went through a fertility clinic. So we actually, you know, have tried to pursue that. But it does get a little bit, you know, more challenging to answer some of the questions as she gets older. But there, you know, it really fits with her, you know, stage of development. She wants to know where she's coming from. And I can really understand that. So, you know, we want to be supportive of that and help her through it. But at the same time, we're not able to get in contact with the biological mom, you know, we'll have to help her deal with that as well.
You know, Alan, what you're saying really resonates with me in terms of using understanding of like development to help sort of separate, you know, yourself from any questions that could feel potentially hurtful, or we might translate them in our adults' minds and feel like they are almost judgmental or something, you know, against our family structure. And for me, using that lens of saying, well, this is just my kid's process and how they become, you know, the full grown version of themselves and their own, develop their own stories and narratives about their life. So it gives me, empowers me to sort of push through anything that might kind of touch on more sensitive subjects for me. Like, you know, as an example, Sage is sort of, I think, because it was, they were so young, like kind of forgetting some of the things, the original details of my life before I transitioned. And so recently asked what my old name was. So before I changed it, and it really bothered me. I mean, I want so badly to kind of live this fantasy that my name and my identity were always mine. And, you know, to put that past away, because fundamentally things like saying my old name makes me feel dysphoric. But as a parent, I really felt like it was important to be honest, because this is Sage's history too. And I think it's important for them to be able to integrate and organize their memories. So, I mean, we're kind of constantly, all of us, writing, rewriting and reprocessing our life stories. So I feel like it's my duty to support my children in that work. So, and like practically speaking, you know, Sage is going to need my need to know my old name anyway, right? So I just sort of told them in that moment, and but also reflected very gently that, you know, that wasn't the right name for me, and doesn't really feel good to reflect on or talk about very much.
I'm really curious, you know, as professionals working with families and working in therapy and psychology, you know, what is it that brings on those questions from kids?
Well, that sort of fear coming up in the adult, to me, definitely speaks to how kind of what we've been talking about, how adults can oftentimes filter questions through their own lens, which often can be a lens that has a lot of insecurity. Like, is this the right kind of family? Am I doing this? Is this okay? Is my kid going to be okay? Am I somehow, maybe that's some internalized, you know, phobia stuff that we're kind of processing as parents, as we're building these families. Like, to your other point, I think that really those questions for the kids oftentimes are just because they're curious and trying to figure out their story, or from peers, which has been my personal experience. So, and, you know, Sage just wants to play and have fun and be respected. That's kind of their main goal in life. So I try to remember that with all these questions or concerns that come up, it's that they just want to be a kid.
I think, you know, kind of looking back, I came out rather late in life. For some reason, I had imagined that once I came out to everyone, I wouldn't have to come out again. I'd just be out. And then you realize that you're constantly coming out to people. I think that's kind of the same sort of thing with kids and having these discussions, is when they meet new people, and it could be their peers or their teachers or other adults, they get these questions and then they're kind of forced into answering them, and they have to, you know, choose what way that they want to answer them. When you can preempt those problems when kids are younger and talk to the adults, that's great, but you're not always going to be there to protect your kids from those situations, and that unfortunately they'll figure out how to deal with them.
So you both have two very different adoption stories. Is there more about international private adoption or foster care and adoption that you'd like to share? Just big open question.
Yes. So for me, being identifying as LGBTQ within the foster care placements lacked the knowledge or the understanding on how to care for or to aid in any kind of resources or any kind of like understanding for someone who identified as LGBTQ, and as well as someone who was a person of color. And so I kind of had a hard time kind of navigating like who to reach out to in ways to like get the sense of like resources and to like understand myself as I was kind of going through this journey of discovering who I was, as well as just not being able to find affirming or accepting placements in identifying as LGBTQ, with just the whole me like being gay, or maybe I would, I think at times they fear that I would change the different children in the home to become gay, or a sense of this whole like predatorial aspect as well. And so they really feared me, I believe. And although like I was also Black as well, or biracial, identified as biracial. So I think that was another kind of factor that kind of dampened in me finding a placement.
Wow, Asim, thank you so much for sharing. Yeah, Emily, you are very correct. We have very different adoption stories. And I think for me, you know, I was adopted as a baby internationally. One thing, Tony Hines is doing some great work with this. And one thing in a recent podcast that he helped moderate that I really, really love and helped expand my understanding and talking to other adoptees too, is just the idea that ethical adoption is an option. So thinking about when folks are prospective parents looking for an adoption agency, really finding one that I mean, number one, supports them as a queer couple or a queer family or a queer person. I know that was a struggle for my family, even trying to adopt me. They were denied in the home study because my mom had a quote unquote roommate and they could see right through that. And so she really had to fight to work with an adoption agency to even adopt in the first place. But finding an adoption agency that also really supports the birth family and the birth mother as much as the adoptive family. I think in that recent podcast episode with Tony, that was just wonderful and great to hear, because I've heard a lot of stories from other adoptees, especially international adoptees, where there's little to no information about the birth family, the birth mother. And there's questionable ethics with that of, did they actually know what was happening? Did they know the outcome? Did they choose that as an option? So even having a choice in the matter, I think, is really important, as opposed to having an agency that just caters to the adoptive, the protective adoptive parent or parents. So I think that is something that is really, really important to me as I move forward in these adoption circles and in the advocacy work.
Family Equality recently created a guide for bi plus people in different sex relationships. And so though the research is limited, what we're seeing does suggest that bi plus people who have children in the context of different sex relationships may be more likely to experience depression and anxiety symptoms in the postpartum period. And, you know, right now that's the speculation is that during that transition to parenthood, there is that loss of identity around sexual orientation and a feeling of disconnection from the LGBTQ plus community. So first, does that speculation feel relevant to you? Is that any part of your experience? Well, Amory, would you?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, definitely. And I've had this experience, you know, like I said, I was married and then we got a divorce and we were co-parenting. And before meeting my current partner, who is a cishet man, you know, I've dated people across various genders. And I've definitely noticed my own internalized, you know, biphobia or my connection with my own queerness in the queer community really change over the years, depending on, you know, if I'm in a relationship with a woman or if I'm in a relationship with someone like my current partner. And through my pregnancy and through, you know, just giving birth and postpartum, I felt a very deep loss of my queer identity. You know, my ex-husband, my daughter's father, was always wonderful and has always affirmed my queerness. But I think especially in my religious family, it was kind of this idea of, oh, Anne Marie's straight now. Anne Marie got married. Anne Marie had a baby. That phase of her life, you know, it's over. And I didn't quite know where I fit in pregnancy and the postpartum period with the queer community. I had my queer friends, but, you know, when I would go to events, I saw families that had a different route to pregnancy and growing their family than I did. And I always felt like I was straddling between these two worlds of being a young married mom, you know, married to a man, and also being a very queer woman and approaching my identity and parenting as a queer woman. So yeah, there was this loss and also this sense of privilege. And it was hard to grapple with that. So it's been an interesting, and you know, now at 28, I feel a very firm and strong connection to my queerness and my queer community, but it was a journey. And I've also been in these relationships and, you know, I've definitely noticed, you know, when I'm partnered with a woman or a person who's not a cis man, I felt more, not accepted, but more, less hesitant to join in queer celebrations and in queer spaces. And there are times, you know, like I said, my partner, he works in queer rights, but he's a straight man. And I've noticed that, you know, even my well-intentioned allies in the work that we're doing, you know, I will get kind of straight washed of like, oh yeah, you know, Anne Marie, and she's partnered with Dominic. And I'm like, you know, yes, and that's not the whole story. You know, regardless of who I'm partnered with, regardless of my parenting status, I am still a queer woman. I do still face, you know, these challenges. And just remember that your bi plus identity, your queer identity is not in conflict with your identity as a parent. It's just a beautiful, beautiful addition to it.
Again, thank you for joining us today. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Outspoken Voices. It really helps others find the show. You can listen to Outspoken Voices on our website, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. You can find Family Equality at familyequality.org and on Facebook and Instagram at Family Equality and on Twitter at
family_equality. For questions, inquiries, or episode suggestions, contact us at outspokenvoices@familyequality.org. And remember that love, justice, and equality is what brings our families together.